The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Azim Azhar, one of LinkedIn's top voices of 2016 and 17. Azim's a keynote speaker and has spoken at such places as the Harvard Business School and London Business School. Azim's also an advisor and advises at such places as Accenture and Omfido, and also is an investor and venture partner at Kindred Capital VC. Thanks, Azim. Anyway, appreciate you taking the time, mate. I know obviously time is a virtue at the moment, and the irony of how much technology is accessible to us at the moment, and especially with everything supposed to be, you're supposed to be able to automate everything these days, but yet we seem like we're still busier than ever. Can't seem to put the two together.
Yeah, well, what it's done is it's made a lot of tasks much easier. Because they're easier, we do more of them. And what it hasn't done is helped us balance between the tasks. So I think many of us who feel like, oh my, we've got so much going on. We do have a lot going on. We're quite productive in terms of output, but I suspect we spend a lot of time flipping from one context to the next. I don't know if that's your experience, but it's certainly mine.
It's true. I don't know whether we quite figured out how to fully leverage and utilize it yet. It's empowering to be able to kind of automate things, but we're kind of at an interesting point of inflection, I think, where we're still carrying a lot of those old habits and haven't quite shaken them off yet. And subsequently, I think it's almost in a paradigm where we're making everyone kind of busier and having to do more than ever. And maybe we'll kind of punch out the other end of that and be in a much more powerful position where we can spend much more time, I suppose, you know, leveraging the intellect that us as humans are capable of. That's at least my idealic vision, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to adopt than to adapt. So the technology can be produced, whatever that technology is, whether it's the plow 20,000 years ago or whether it's the sort of latest mobile phone widget. It can then be put into use quite quickly, but it takes time for our patterns of behavior, our habits and our norms to adjust to that new technology. And so I think what we see today is exactly that. I mean, just take something as simple as email. When I started working, I worked as a journalist at The Guardian, and I was one of the first people there to have internet email. And I still received faxes from for stories at the time, actually for a good year or two after I joined. What was quite interesting was that when companies started to get email, the emails I received were not like the types of emails that you get today, where they're very short and abrupt and have a smiley in them. They were quite formally written, "Dear sir, I wonder if you might," type of emails, almost as if they'd been hammered out on a traditional typewriter, because the adoption of the technology was much easier than the adaptation of the social norms and behaviors. And so when some of the things that you talk about, I think we're seeing exactly the same thing, which is that we haven't quite figured out how the sort of patterns of behavior need to change given the technologies that we now have and the ones that are being introduced.
I think you do go through that. It's like the economy. It's traditionally peaked and troughed pretty much consistently. I think it's on about a 20-year cycle. I think I saw a graph once. That might have been the US economy, but I'm sure it's pretty consistent throughout, where you have these kind of 20-year peaks and troughs. And I think technology is very much like that. You go through these points where it say the peak was this point of inflection that we're at now, where we're leveraging new technology and there's still kind of a large proportion of people that haven't adapted yet. And you kind of get through that, and then you have, you know, a number of years where it does feel as though everyone's taking kind of full advantage of that. Email is the great example. People all of a sudden got on board with it, and subsequently the most commonly used platform now. I think we're at an interesting point in reflection with technologies like a lot of automation work, and I think we're kind of getting there, but maybe we're a good few years away before socially it has been rolled out. It's strange, isn't it? Some of these technologies, they're years and years and years old, but for humans to actually change their behavior and embrace them, that's where the hard work, that's where that kind of change management is so difficult. The technology seems like it's, relatively speaking, it is easy compared to actually getting humans to behave differently.
I think that's very true. The technology is relatively easy. And it's both about sometimes individual humans, different people adapt and are intrigued and curious about change to in some contexts compared to other contexts. I think everybody is quite, shows in some parts of their behavior, some degree of that sort of curiosity and willingness to lean in and adjust something. It gets very complex when you end up with organizations and incentives. So if you look at something like what is the pattern with which people have shifted their viewing from linear to on-demand? So in other words, from watching those sort of scheduled channels through to watching YouTube and Netflix and BBC iPlayer, considering how much inertia there ought to have been 20 years ago, many hours on these linear channels, we've actually moved very quickly towards a model of people watching on demand. And I think the reason you see that is that there aren't the complex interpersonal dynamics when you think about your watching habits, right? I mean, probably the most complex it gets is within the context of a family of 3, 4, or 5 people. So when you think about technology change in organizations, one reason it takes such a long time is because of the complexity of communication of all the different people in the organization who have a stake or are impacted by that change. And lots of our organizations have got the incentives set up in the wrong way to adapt towards change. And that's both the story in a really existential perspective when you're thinking about companies like Kodak and Blockbuster that had sort of great market positions and were wiped out by technology change. But most true as well about companies when they think about their own internal IT systems and what sort of changes they need to make. And so to your point, when we think about things like these automation technologies, one reason they would have taken a long time, even though they're quite old, is exactly that sort of complexity of who's really incentivized to work the weekend to implement this earlier rather than later.
I think as people, you know, we want what's going to make sense for us. I think at the brunt of it, and I think our selfishness at times potentially gets in the way of, you know, things like innovation, right? I mean, because people want it, and it's interesting that I spent some time over in California, worked for a couple of startups out there, and was part of incubators where you see hundreds of different startups. And it was interesting because there was the few that were like incredibly innovative, and the people working on them just phenomenally intelligent, working on very complex problems. And the sad thing about it is that the ones that made it were always kind of at the brunt of it, the simplest ideas. They were the ones that were here and now, and it's very difficult to come up with these concepts that are so long term that we actually embrace them. There's very, very few of those ideas ever get the backing and the support. I think we're in a place now where I think that's probably changed, and there are investors maybe behaving a little bit differently. But at the time, it certainly was the case. People wanted the idea that made that was simple. The Dollar Shave Club, for instance, something like that was the one that, you know, really took off, because it was just, this is what human habit is. We're not trying to fight that. We can build something and make it work. And all these ideas and these concepts that they seem like hard work, there's no one really knows what it is, there's a huge education piece that goes into it. Those ideas, it's 0.001% of those ideas that actually ever materialize into something that as a culture we embrace. And that's all because of habits and kind of us not willing to change. And I can imagine, and it might be interesting to get your take, because you probably had a really interesting perspective starting off as a journalist, because you obviously have such more of a macro view on things, as opposed to if you'd have probably just gone and worked for a tech company. So what did you kind of see in those days when you started off in journalism and you were able to have that kind of broad perspective on things?
It was a long time ago. It was the early 90s. And the thing that I picked up was just that attitude towards innovation and change really, really varied in location to location. So I remember back in 98 or 99, when I was no longer a journalist, meeting the CEO of one of the major mobile telecoms networks. And he said to me he would never, and his word was never, allow billing data for customers, in other words, your customer bill, be accessible over the internet. Now, he was right. He never did allow it, because it was a subsequent CEO who did allow it at one level. But it was more that sort of attitude, which I think it's partly about whether you have a growth mindset. I mean, if you work in a technology business, you need that growth mindset, because the reality is nothing really works. And it doesn't work for a very long time. And the more complex systems get, the more complex the problems that arise, emerge from them get. So cybersecurity is not necessarily a design flaw. It's emerged from the complexity of having billions of people connected to these disparate systems. So I think, if you work in the technology industry, you necessarily have to be a practical optimist, because version one of what you produce is just going to be a bit shonky. And so you get used to this notion that you have to kind of continually improve things. Now, what I have observed over the last 20 or 30 years is that there seem to be things that are not related to technology that affect the way people think about this notion of change, right? And I think partly that is about a sense of optimism and a sense of, do your better days lie in front of you, or your better days in the past? And that gets driven then by your cultural tropes, and it gets driven by your media commentary. So while we talk about, people being a bit slow taking on technology and so on, and we're both sitting here in the UK, if you think about what's happened in China over the last 30 years, and the fact that hundreds of millions of people have fundamentally changed their techno-economic paradigm, because they have moved from living in the countryside, sort of on farms, into tier 3, 4, 2, and 1 cities, in a highly digital, highly mobile, e-payments, e-cash, online to offline, mobile-driven services. They've made that transition individually, and it's been significant. They've done it in a few years, and they've made it in aggregate to society very, very quickly, because they're kind of optimistic about the power of the technology to make the change. And I think in large parts of the US, there is also an optimism about what technology can do. And obviously it's true in the Bay Area, but it's also true in other patches. And then you see patches of the US where they're really not optimistic about technology. And they're looking back towards previous models to say, why can't it be like that? And these are the people who are probably more resistant to the change. Now I think that the challenge here is that as technologists, the responsibility can't be to force change onto people. I mean, you can do that in certain environments. I think the Chinese have been able to do this by aligning, state media, local incentives, tax incentives, governments that supported investment in such a way that it underlies an overall direction for the society towards the intelligent economy in 2030. But in general, unless you can control all of those pieces, you can't just go out and say, here's another brilliant widget and you must like it and you must take it. In our societies, we have mechanisms through the process of elections and referendums where people can say, no, I don't like that. I don't like that. And I think that the kind of things that large organizations have done, which is that whenever they do a transformation, which is almost always inevitably driven by some form of technology implementation. They have a change process that sits on top of it, and that change process involves consensus building and communication, clarification, stakeholder engagement, and it takes months, right? And it's nothing to do with the Java code that you're running or the services you're running on Microsoft Azure, and it's everything to do with people's subjective experience, how this affects them, what will it mean for their job, what will it mean for their bonus, what will it mean for the team that they work in. Now, when we think about how technology makes its way in society, we haven't really thought about that. We haven't thought, and what we've been reliant on is that process gets driven by our politicians and it gets driven by our media. And the question is, within the UK, how good a job have they really done of that? We have some politicians who clearly understand technology well. And, you know, Matt Hancock, who's the new health secretary, is a great example of that. But over the last 15 years, can we really say that our business leaders and public figures have given a fair and sensible account of what's going on in a realistic, optimistic way? And I suspect they haven't, and I suspect that's what creates all sorts of tensions and actually reduces the rate with which we can take advantage of the good things and tackle the downsides.
Going back to you for a second on that, your initiative and desire to subsequently, from journalism, get involved in technology projects, get involved in the venture capital side of things. Like, what was the motivation? Because you weren't, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't technical when you started out. So what was the kind of the motivating path to pursue this?
Well, I was reasonably technical. I started coding when I was 9. I still have both my first computer and my first assembly code manual back from 1981. I coded throughout my secondary school years. I was really lucky in that we managed to get hold of one of the first handful of RISC processors produced by then Acorn Computing that became ARM. It was a co-processor that sat next to BBC Micro. But I've always been someone who's been kind of left brain and right brain in that sense. So my degree is in, you know, philosophy and economics and politics. But again, I was the only student out of a 1500 or so in my year group who also took the C++ course. So I've always had a sense of that. But clearly, compared to someone who's done a computer science degree and has spent 15 years in engineering departments, I'm a not even a minnow. I'm like an amoeba compared to their whale-like skills. I think the thing that I've come to realize about technology and the way that I present it is that it's not a thing that is separate to our life in itself. Technology and innovation are things that exist in every family, every household in the day to day. You know, when you figure out that there's a better way of resealing the mincemeat in cling film using paper clips, right? And that's just your way. Well, that's a technological innovation. And it's a very natural part of how we have generally lived our lives. I think what has happened, and I think it's, as I said, it's a lot of this is driven by the media and by the public discourse, is this establishment of an us and them culture about the people who are technologists and the people who aren't. And the fact that as technologists, we have terms of art, because there's no real way to discuss a consensus mechanism or parallelism in terms that aren't highly technical, in the same way that a cardiologist needs to use highly technical terms when they're to avoid ambiguity. But we've sometimes allowed those terms of art to not have the interface with the outside world, with the external world, and that there's a gap between the language and the vocabulary and the understanding of one to the other. Now, in the last 3 years, I've been writing a newsletter called Exponential View, just on, you know, on the side. It's doing, you know, and it's doing pretty well. I think it takes people as technical as they want to get if you're not a technologist, but it also drives you as far into the political economy and the public discourse as you'll want to get if you are a technologist. And one of the things that I've been really pleased that I have seen happen externally is that three and a half years ago when I started this, I started to write about, you know, for example, bias in AI algorithms, right? The issue that if your training data is skewed, that will be reflected and optimized by whatever maths you layer on top of it. Or looking at the point that there is a natural tendency towards some kind of monopoly control within these large platform companies like the sort of Facebooks and Googles. Those things were not being written about by the mainstream back in 2015 and not in the details to which I was sort of tackling them. They are now becoming mainstream. And what's happening is that the reason we feel that the press is full of technology stories at the moment is because non-technical journalists have brought their disciplines to these questions and they've wised and smarted themselves up. So I think the quality of debate around these questions is very, very much higher than it was 3 or 4 years ago. And I think that's actually a very good thing because we're asking sensible questions about the technology, which includes both the good questions about its potential and the tougher questions about who gets to roll it out, what the impacts are, what the costs are going to be, how do we make sure that there is a sort of better, more broader, more equitable participation in all of this.
It reminds me of the statement that I know a lot of people have made that we're going to be coming into a world where it's going to be required that you know how to code. And my take on that, right, is that I think that that stands, but it's not saying that everyone needs to do software development. It's saying that you have to understand what's going on and you can't be ignorant to the fact that this is happening and you need to understand it to a level so you can articulate how that fits in with, you know, what your work balance is. And I think that's what the bigger statement is, right, is that we can't ignore it. Like you said, you can't, it's not us and them. It's not technology and us. It is a cultural shift. You know, I've had a lot of CDOs on this podcast and the main consistency that I've had from them when they're coming into organizations, historical organizations, and trying to implement best data practices, it's not just something where you can have the data department. It's a cultural shift. It is a complete cultural shift. And that's where their overriding problems is with that shift in mentality. And in order to do that, the first thing you've got to do is try and educate people. And it's the same thing across the board. And like you say, we are at this point now where it is, whether we like it or not, even in the most kind of brick and mortar jobs possible, technology is still now part of what you're doing. So you need to understand it on a deeper level. Not necessarily practice it, but at least understand it. And you can probably look at maybe the education system and question them. It's like, are they late to the party for this? Are we the next generation? Are we giving them the resources that they need to be best positioned to understand these things?
Well, I would say that I would agree with you that people need to know about the practice of coding. And the way I think a bit about it is, do you know the thought processes, the kind of the analytics, the step-by-step thinking, the engineering mindset coupled with the scientific method of small experiments and testing? Do you have an understanding of integration and system level issues? Because you actually deal with those sorts of things every single day. So for example, even packing a family to go on a vacation, which is something that many of us will be doing over the summer, It is a systems level problem, right? How do you optimize each suitcase for the load and for practicality? How do you put them all in the back of the car, given that you're taking a few suitcases? I mean, those are the kind of things that actually one does every day if you're running a sort of a software business. I'm not sure everybody actually needs to code. I need to know the ins and outs of Haskell or Scala. And I also think that the nature of how we plan to deploy software is going to change very rapidly. So that is a kind of critical paradigm shift that has already emerged from what I would call a sort of a Newtonian Maxwell model where you have an all-knowing programmer who can understand every variable in the system and so codes something to produce a given output, and therefore you have a lot of brittle systems, to a And by the way, that programmer claims that the system is deterministic. And then you compare to what we do now with a machine learning position, which is a much more of a sort of Heisenbergian, Borean model of the world of, uncertainty, where you go from a set of observations, the data, and you learn from those observations, and you try to represent a model of the world that's going to be more or less accurate. And so it's probabilistic, and that's what's happening within the domain of machine learning. And it's a real inversion about the way in which we think we're going to construct software. And that means that I suspect a lot of the millions of developers in the world who are trying to turn a model of the world into mathematics, which is what their coding is, will find themselves actually saying, look, here's the model of the outcomes that we want that are either through observation in the real world or generated through simulation. And we now want to, without peering too deeply into the black box, construct a system that takes the correct inputs and delivers the right outputs, right? And that's a learning process. So more programmers will look like data scientists. And then the people who write the tools for the data scientists will need to be further between, because they'll be able, those tools will be leveraged much, much higher. So I think one job category that will kind of fundamentally change will be that. And what that then means is, in order to be a great data scientist, do you really actually need to have expertise in PHP and C#? And the answer is, probably not, is my sense. So, I agree with you. I think that the underlying tool set of statistical thinking and computational thinking and those things I discussed earlier is really, really critical to just being able to understand and navigate the world in a way that doesn't make appeals to the supernatural, right? As a kind of fundamental naturalist way of looking at the world. But I don't think we need to necessarily go out and say everybody needs to code. Now, if getting everyone to code within the education system is a way of imparting those skills that we've discussed, then we should get everybody to code. But it's not the ultimate objective.
Like I say, I think you are probably articulated the point a lot better than me. It's not hard to do, by the way. But I think it's an interesting one, because my only take on it, and this is probably from my experience, as I kind of took to learning basic fundamentals of code a lot later than most, I think. And what was interesting for me was that I found it actually quite intimidating that other people knew how to code. And therefore, in my mind, even though when I got into it, the fundamentals of it and the strategic thinking of it, they came really, really naturally to me. I think typically I'm quite good in that sense. But because it was this code and there was this, it felt like it was this kind of club, and it just made it feel like it was a lot different. And there was that intimidation side to it. And I've had a few people on the show actually who spoke about similar things to that. So for me, even though I 100% agree with you on it's the way of thinking, it's not necessarily like, I think it's a very strong case that you made about, the direction that data science is going to have to go. It's not going to be paramount for them to be able to do PHP and such. But I do think that if you can get people to code and get them comfortable with it, it's almost like alleviates any of that kind of fear and, that kind of us culture that I think from an outsider looking in still exists. And I think for me, that's the point, that the only point that I think would be missing and why it is probably important for, young people to at least learn how to code and get the basics and then realize that, actually it's not as crazy and scary as I thought. All these lines aren't that scary. I can understand this. And then teaching people how to think, implementing different methodologies, agile and such, I think will then be kind of the core of what you need to be successful.
Yeah, I think you can make progress on this problem of it looking like a club or a subculture with its own coding, dress and language and so on, that's quite hard to access in a number of really practical ways. So I have three kids, who the eldest of whom is just become a teenager, and I think getting them to engage even with something as high level as Python is pretty challenging. So you have to, I think, demonstrate the value of some of the approaches that one will need. Now, just may give you a caveat here, right? I don't know whether this works because it's too early in the in my experience. But the way that I've approached it is that we use Scratch quite a lot and Hopscotch before that. These are two visual block-based programming languages. One's available on the iPad, the other's available just on any sort of web browser. But they force that kind of systematic thinking, which is, if I want the cat icon to move up to the top corner, how do I break that down? Well, that's like a step to the left and then up, then a step to the left and then up, then a step to the left and then up. And that starts to give you some of these principles of, loops and recursion, even questions like testing. So I want this thing to be a little bit more complex. I want it to avoid a bunch of obstacles. Well, what we need to do is we need to try avoid one obstacle before we try to avoid two obstacles. And those start to give you the principles of what it is to work in this world that is going to be interfaced with a lot of software, and not just individual software systems, but software systems that integrate with each other and have sort of strange emergent effects because we didn't expect to ever connect the two of them together. When you and I were growing up, probably the worst case of mechanical feedback we ever got was when we accidentally moved a microphone too close to a speaker, and the thing got, created a howling feedback loop. In a world where you're living within software, those sorts of inconsistencies happen, they happen all of the time. And I think, people who understand what the system is doing, underneath, can live with a much higher degree of relaxation and ease than those for whom this is a black box. And I'll give you a really tiny example. I had a problem with my car a couple of weeks ago, and we called in to, get a recovery van to come and sort of pick it up, and got cut off as phone calls often do. So when I called back in, the new agent couldn't access my records because my records were already open with the old agent. Now, anyone who's worked in software knows what's happened, right? Which is that to avoid contention, you end up keeping the file open so it's unwritable by a second agent. And so, your only choice, frustrating though it is to wait 5 or 10 minutes for that file to hit its timeout, and then you can call back in again. And you can argue that the recovery company should have had a more well-designed system, but there's nothing you can do at the time. So it's not a black box for me. I wait 10 minutes and I call back in, and I have that much better moment of ease. I do get frustrated, by the way, when I run into poorly designed systems, but at least I'm frustrated at their poor design rather than kind of beating my fist at a black box that I just don't and can't understand. And I think as we move towards this space where more and more of what we do is mediated through software that will never be perfectly written, and even if it was perfectly written, will interact with other software in unpredictable ways, giving oneself the computational literacy to understand those systems, to feel that one could have built them oneself, to get an empathy for the people who have created them and why they might interact in unforeseen ways, I think is super important.
Azeem, I think we'll leave there, mate. Mate, I really enjoyed the chat. Thank you so much for taking the time. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.